Welcome to iTruth, the teaching ministry of Fellowship Bible Church, Texarkana, Texas. Fellowship Bible Church exists to help believers and seekers become fully devoted followers of Jesus Christ. Following is a message delivered by Andy Tuttleby, our student pastor here at Fellowship Bible Church. We trust that it will be beneficial to your walk with Jesus Christ.
Please be seated.
You know, a couple of months ago, Richard asked me to preach on May 11th. I didn't realize what day it was, so I said, sure, no problem. Just put me down on the calendar, that's great. A few weeks ago, he mentioned that May 11th was Mother's Day. I'm like, oh, okay, great, no problem. And he's like, you can just preach on whatever you want. I'm like, perfect. So I went back in my office and started jotting down ideas and thinking and praying and whatever else. And it dawned on me, it's like, it's Mother's Day. I can't possibly get away with getting up in front of all the mothers and preaching on something else. I'd never make it out alive. So I was like, okay, well, fair enough. We'll do something on mothers. That's, you know, shouldn't be too hard to do. And as I started preparing for stuff, I realized there are so many ways I can get myself into trouble. So I went down the hall and knocked on Richard's door and stuck my head in. I'm like, do you have any suggestions on how I do this? Because I can dig a hole for myself really, really quickly here. He's like, oh, yeah. He says, with a grin, he says, I've done that multiple times. I'm like, thanks. So, Richard, if you're listening, thanks. Appreciate it much. He went on to tell me with a big grin on his face about the one year where he decided to get cute, thought he'd be clever, and his sermon title was How to Be a Bad Mother. And the whole idea was it was this tongue-in-cheek kind of, he'd say, you know, these bad things that mothers never do. And all the women would come away feeling encouraged and built up because they're not anything like that. The problem was, is that, and you ladies, you all know this, motherhood is not this perfect thing. You're dealing with these imperfect little people who don't do what they're told and don't turn out the way they're supposed to. And there's no easy formula for it. And so what ended up happening is everything he listed off on his list of what not to do, as it were, someone had done at some point in time. So he was feeling pretty proud of himself. He thought this is great. He gets home and Vicky closed the door behind him and turned and looked at him and said, don't ever do that again. Now, you have to understand this is Vicky, so she probably had a big grin on her face and a big smile on her face when she said it, but she was actually upset, okay? And he's like, what'd I do? And she explained to him, he's like, oh man, I feel terrible. So thank you, Richard, for setting me up for this. But I figured I'd start off by throwing Richard under the bus and then hopefully it's uphill from here. You know, I can appreciate what Richard was trying to do. I can't speak to the execution because I wasn't actually there. But I know from my own experience with Elisa, you guys, you ladies, are too hard on yourselves. You have an incredibly challenging role and job with raising kids. Because we don't want to just raise kids, we want to raise godly kids. And they don't always cooperate. In fact, they rarely cooperate. But y'all are too hard on yourselves, and I wanted to kind of give you an example of, right early on in Genesis, if you have your Bibles, go ahead and turn to Genesis with me. Of a time where, you know, I was talking with someone this morning, and I said, you know, the dangers of me getting something wrong here, I said, because there's a strong chance that in trying to kind of raise women up, I might not get it. And this guy looked at me and says, you don't get it. You're a guy. I'm like, that's exactly what I'm afraid of. So anyway, I'm going to hopefully do my best. But I want to show you a guy who got it early on. And hopefully this will encourage you ladies as well. If you look at Genesis chapter 1, we'll start with there. In verse 5 it says, God called the light day and the darkness he called night, and there was evening, there was morning the first day. And there's a whole series of verses following that where God spoke and creation came about. In ancient cultures, when this was kind of being read by people, they would have understood what was going on here. By God calling the light day and calling the night the darkness night. It was kind of a sign of ownership and dominion. God was in control of it. The Bible talks about everything in the earth and around the earth is the Lord's. He owns it. He's in dominion over it. Okay? When Adam was created, God brought the animals to him. In chapter 2, verse 19, it says, the Lord God had formed out of the ground all the wild animals and all the birds in the sky. He brought them to the man to see what he would name them. Again, Adam had been charged with the task of ruling in dominion over the earth that God had created. And as he named them, it was understood that there was dominion, there was ownership, there was control there. And so whatever the man called each living creature, that was its name. In chapter 3, verse 20, it says, after Eve was taken out of his rib or whatever else, it says, Adam named his wife Eve. Now let me just stop right there before you think I'm digging a hole for myself here. This was not the same thing, and there's a qualifying statement to that verse. This was, obviously Adam was to be the head of Eve, and she was to be in submission to him, but this wasn't just a control thing. It was much, much more than that. He goes on to qualify his statement. He says, Adam named his wife Eve because she would become the mother of all the living. Now, the fascinating thing about this verse and this passage is it comes right on the heel of the fall of man. It comes right on the tail end of, as we all know, Eve succumbing to the temptation of the serpent. And Eve, generally speaking, gets the large portion of the blame for that. You know, we all know Adam only went along with it because he didn't want to lose Eve. And so he's like, well, I better go quickly too, or else I'm, you know, that wouldn't be good. Okay? But so, we all know Eve, generally speaking, gets a large portion of the blame for that. And that falling into that sin was devastating for humanity. It was going to be devastating for any of her future offspring all the way down to us even now. It was, you can't underestimate how huge it was. But right on the tail end of that, Adam is not interested in rearing that up. He's not interested in throwing that in her face. He's not interested in thinking of her in those terms. The way Adam wants her to be remembered is as the mother of all the living. That every human that comes on the earth after this will be because of Eve. She is the mother of all the. He was revering her and honoring her even after this colossal mistake. So I just want to encourage you, ladies. Yes, parenthood as a whole is a minefield. It's tricky. You all make mistakes. We, as fathers, make mistakes. Our kids make mistakes. We're all sinful people. But the beauty of it is that Adam's initial response right afterwards was to revere and honor this woman that God had put in his life. And hopefully what I'm going to do today will kind of do a little bit of the same with you guys. Because it's a role and a task that the Lord has given you guys. And as you do it, and you all do, many of you guys, you all do it so, so well, it raises up and glorifies God as you undertake this incredible challenge and this task that God has blessed you with. The mother's role is to point her children to Christ. It's no easy task, and there's no one-size-fits-all way of doing it. It requires intuition, gentleness, firmness, love, comfort, guidance, strength, just to name a few. We could probably spend all day just listing off what it takes. Okay? Richard Strauss, in an article called The Majesty of Motherhood, said, motherhood is undoubtedly one of the most complex and exacting callings in life. While dad is the leader in the house, the mother sets the tone. The hours her children spend in her presence will have a lasting influence on their lives. They will become largely what she makes them. She faces the noble challenge of molding their young lives for eternity. Mother is one of the highest honors, and it's also one of the heaviest responsibilities. I couldn't agree more. How am I doing so far? Have I got myself into trouble yet? I'm okay so far? Okay, good. I figured that if I inadvertently insulted mothers today, I might get a dirty look or an earful when I get home. I might get some dirty looks on my way out today, so I figured I'd play it safe. And I figured rather than inadvertently insulting the ladies, I'd kind of somewhat intentionally insult the guys. We live in a society that tends to dumb down fatherhood and dumb down guys, and I don't want to do that, but I want to kind of have a little fun with it. And so I've entitled my sermon, Why Men Are Not Mothers. Okay, I think that always conjures up a whole lot of images and ideas for you guys. There's the obvious reason. I'm not going to go into that, okay? But I just want to kind of list off a few, and then we'll kind of talk. I'll talk through them as we go, okay? First off is threshold for pain. Men don't have one, okay? It's really small. You know, we talk about how women are the weaker sex. I'm yet to figure out where that statement came from. Because the more I watch my wife and what I know of my mother and how she raised us and the time and effort and energy she put in and the pain and suffering that me and my brothers and my sister caused her, weak does not describe it. Not in the least. You know, us guys, and guys, you'll attest to this, when we get sick, we're sick. It's like, we're hopeless. We can't do anything. We can't function. We're like, hit the couch, give me the remote control and bring me stuff to make me feel better. Keep the kids quiet and out of the way. Just leave me alone. I'm done. And we are sick until we are better, and then we kind of get back up and get on with things. Half the time, I don't know when my wife is sick until she mentions at the end of the day that she's had a splitting headache all day. Or that she's felt horrible all day long. And she's been to work, she's come home and taken care of the kids, done all the stuff that she normally does, and I must be completely unintuitive because I didn't pick up on any of that. It's like, you should have said something. I could have gotten off the couch and helped a little more. Okay? But it's almost as if the women's pain threshold is so high, it's like motherhood comes first. And it's like, it doesn't matter what they're going through, it doesn't get in the way of them taking care of their children and their family and the home. Another reason that men are not mothers is a bedside manner. Again, generally speaking, mothers have it, guys, and this is a generalization, I realize that, but guys don't. Oftentimes, guys have the bedside manner of a drill sergeant. Compassion is not always our first response. I remember when I was growing up and I was young in England, probably about six or so, and my dad was teaching me how to ride a bike. And, so we started off, we had the stabilizers on the back wheels so that it kind of kept me upright. And he'd kind of hold the back of the saddle and kind of guide me down the street. And we'd go relatively slowly to start off with. And then I got pretty good at that. And so we raised the stabilizers up a little bit so they weren't doing as much. And then it got to the point where it's like stabilizers are coming off. This is the big day. This is the big test. This is the culmination of the accomplishment for my dad. He's taught his son how to ride a bike. So we're going down, and in Ireland they've got these like pavement or pathways, kind of like the street, and then there's these pathways alongside the houses. And so I'm pedaling away, proud of myself. And my dad, every now and then I check, and my dad's right behind me, holding the saddle, just keeping me upright. And I'm going down the street, and after a while, I started getting a little too good, and I got too fast for him. And so my dad's running like crazy, trying to keep up and holding at the handle, and then it's like he can't reach anymore, and he just lets go. And my dad's like, my son's doing it. And so he starts cheering. I hear, oh, yes, you're going. And so and that voice gets more distant and distant in the back. So what do? I look over my shoulder to see why my dad's voice is not like right behind me like it had been all the other times. Well, and predictably, I lose control, veered off and landed in the rose bushes of Mrs. Robinson. Scratched up, cut up, bleeding, what, nasty. Terrible. We get home, and my dad's still bragging about how he taught his son to ride a bike. He was doing it! He was like, for like 20 yards, he was doing it! My mother's first response is like, what happened to you? She comforts me. She comes alongside. She starts cleaning the wounds. And my dad's still relishing in the fact that he's taught his son to ride a bike. Clueless. Oftentimes, Sadly, ladies, that's exactly where we guys are. Isaiah 66 says this. He says, as a mother comforts her child, so will God comfort you, and you will be comforted over Jerusalem. 2 Corinthians 1:3 says, praise be to the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of compassion and the God of all comfort, who comforts us in all of our troubles, so that we can comfort those in any trouble with the comfort that we ourselves receive from God. Ladies, the comfort that you have given to your kids from when they were, you know, tiny to even now, some of us who are adults, has enabled us to extend the comfort of God to others that we come into contact with. You know, you thought you were just loving on your kid, but God had greater plans for it. He was in taking His love through you to your child, and that love has gone out into the world, into the people that your children come into contact with. That comfort is spreading, and God is getting the glory for that. Incredible thing is in John 14:26, God says that He's going to send, Jesus says to His disciples, I will send you a comforter. Or another other way it says a counselor or a helper, intercessor. It's talking about the Holy Spirit. You in many ways have a similar role as the Holy Spirit does with believers, is to comfort and guide and just nurture. The third thing, I think we're on number three, are we? I think the third thing, reason that men are not mothers, is that there's no instruction manual for us to ignore. You know, when we first went to the hospital for labor and delivery with James in Austin, St. David's, you know, it's an exciting time. And as a guy, I just kind of got caught up in the excitement. I didn't really think too much about what happened after the baby was delivered. You're just there trying to get through and, you know, wincing with pain as the wife, you know, as Lisa squeezes my hand. Actually, she didn't do that. She was great. Okay, but it kind of creeps up on you, as it did to me. In the hospital, everything was fine. Labor and delivery was a breeze. I didn't feel a thing. Fabulous. You know, there was the usual recovery time of a day or so. And then we were discharged. And it's exciting. We took the elevator down to the lobby. And, you know, and Elise is in the wheelchair because they don't let you walk out. You know, as soon as you get out the hospital doors, you're on your own. You know, it's like, thanks, we'll take the wheelchair back now. You're good to go. It's like, what? You know? So I wheeled her out, and we get out, and I went out and got the car and pulled the car around, and you got the car seat all strapped in, ready to go and everything else. And so I, you know, help Elisa into the front seat and give her the seatbelt to buckle herself up, and I take the baby, and I'm making sure I've got everything buckled in right or whatever else. And I hop in the front seat, ready to drive home, and it hits me. Wait, the nurses and doctors aren't coming home with us? What are we supposed to do? See, this is huge. Wait, hold on. They're trusting us with this little precious bundle? Wait, they're trusting me with this precious bundle? What are they thinking? They've got to be nuts. There's no instruction manual for raising kids. You know, the Bible has some great principles and whatever in there, but it's generally speaking not all condensed into one thing. And you know, as guys, we don't read instruction manuals anyway. You know, I remember at the time there was a friend of mine who was just graduating college. It was I think I was still a senior at the time, and he was graduating, and they were getting ready to go to Mexico as missionaries. So they bought this big giant car rack thing to house all of their stuff so that they could drive down to Mexico. So he called me up, and we went over to help them. Which, you know, Elisa's inside with Marta, and I'm outside with Victor trying to put this thing together. And so, you know, there's the instruction manual comes with it. So we promptly picked it up and tossed it one side. So who needs an instruction manual? How hard can this thing be? It's obvious. It looks like that. And we put it on the roof and we're good to go. We must have spent about an hour and a half putting this thing together. And we were real proud of ourselves. It looked good. So we go in and we call up ladies. Hey, ladies, we're ready to roll. Come on, see the grand finale. We'll put it on top of the car. So they come out and they're all excited. And they're like, wow, that does look good. You guys did a great job. So we picked the thing up and we put it on the car and realized that the way the thing was designed, you had to attach it to the roof first and then build the rest of it. It took us another hour to dismantle the whole thing, take it all apart, read the instructions properly this time, and then do it the correct way. guys don't follow instructions real well. This is part of the reason that God made women mothers and not men. Because women have no problem asking for help, asking for advice, you know, talking with their mothers or their mother-in-law or elder ladies in the church, people who have had experience, who have done it all before and finding out. You know, I know some of you guys, even now, some of you have blogs of your own. Some of you guys read blogs about how to be a mother. You're not at all shy about going in and gathering as much information as you can. You know, my wife read What to Expect When You're Expecting, and then I think the follow-up is What to Expect After You've Expected, and so on and so forth. Okay? Guys don't do a good job with that. And we need all the help that we can get. One of the probably more profound pieces of advice I think that we got for parents, as parents, early parents, came from my mother-in-law. And she was visiting shortly after we brought James home. It was maybe a year or so in when he was starting to crawl. I don't know what age to start to crawl. Anyway, well, he was crawling, okay? Put it that way. And my mother-in-law was there. And you know the way you hear everyone tells you got to baby-proof the house? You know, you put all little soft, cushiony things on the corners of the sharp objects. And anything that they can get their little hands on that you don't want them to break or swallow or whatever else, you put up higher. Even my cat learned to sleep on top of the TV. This is before flat screen TVs when they're like that thin. It was like, you know, deeper. When we got the flat screen, he didn't know what to do with it. But he used to sleep up on the TV and kind of watch James from below as the, James was grabbing after everything. And so we had kind of sort of begun to baby-proof the house and start moving everything up. And my mother-in-law came to visit and she's like, oh, don't do that. I'm like, what are you, nuts? He could swallow something, break something. Everyone says to baby-proof the house. It's kind of what you do. She said, you're right. You need to, but don't put everything away. She says, find one or two objects that he can't hurt and he can't hurt himself with and leave them within arm's reach. I'm like, why? He's just going to grab them and suck on them and drool all over them. And why would we leave something? She's like, so you can start teaching him from a very young age that there's such thing as no. I'm like, really, he's going to learn that at one or two? Well, yeah. And I remember watching Elisa very calmly but consistently. She'd watch James and he'd start crawling across the room at these one or two things that we'd left, and he'd reach up and he'd grab a hold of it. And she'd come up, gently come down to him, and she'd take it from his hand and she'd say, no, you leave that alone, James. You don't touch that. And like he can understand what you're saying. Put it back right where it was. I'm like, well, don't put it there. He's going to grab it again. Put it up higher. If you don't want him to take it, put it away. She's like, this is what my mom said. Let's try it. And she'd go back to the kitchen. And she'd put James on the opposite side of the room. And he'd wait a few seconds. And he'd spy the little object again. And off he'd go. He'd start crawling and working his way to the other side of the room. And he'd get to the object, pick it up. And Lisa would come over and say, I said no. A little more firmly this time. Put it back. Pick him up, put him on the other side of the room, lay him on his back, make it a little tougher for him. And again, it's like he would roll over, crawl over to the room. Well, over time, it got to the point where he would reach out, and then he kind of glanced to see if she was paying attention. And it's like, oh my goodness, he's a little sinner. He's figured out what no means. It's don't touch it. But he doesn't care. And so he'd reach out like, are you going to come? But the amazing thing was, is watching as he grew older, and my other kids too, they learned what no meant. And they learned from a young age that there were going to be times where the answer to their question or what they want or whatever else was going to be, no, it's not good for you. And they learned to accept it from that young age. Made it much easier to discipline them when they were older because they were already used to the idea. Stroke of genius. Would never have thought of that myself. And thankfully, my wife was open to suggestions and things like that, that we were able to utilize some of those skills. Titus 2, 3 through 5 says this, likewise, teach the older women, this is Paul writing to Titus, teach the older women to be reverent in the way that they live, and to teach what is good to the younger women. This is the way the body of Christ operates. We get to learn from one another. And thankfully, mothers are willing and open to learning from one another and learning skills and processes and ways that they can raise godly children. Because you don't, it's not just naturally intuitive. You know, common sense anymore is not very common. And so it's great that we have women who are humble enough to accept advice from one another and look to each other for good ways of raising our children. Fourth reason that men are not mothers is a thing they call mother's intuition. I think basically the Bible would probably describe that as simply wisdom. Again, something oftentimes guys don't have a whole lot in supply, but women often do. My dad used to tell me when I was in my early 20s, at one point I was talking to him about a decision I'd had to make, and he made the comment, he says, "You're very wise." I'm like, "Oh, I don't know about that. Maybe I got this one right." You know, a blind squirrel finds an acorn every now and then. You know, so he says, "No, really." He says, "You've grown into a wise young man who's making good decisions with your life." He says, "And you would never remember this." He says, "But your mother started that process very, very young." I'm like, "What are you talking about?" He says, "I used to think she was crazy." He said, "But when you were like, you know, 3 or 4, you'd get up for preschool or whatever in the morning, and she would lay out 2 sets of clothes for you, or she'd say, 'Do you want to wear this or this?'" And he's like, "The kid's like 3 or 4. Just throw him some clothes, put them on him, and get him out the door. What are we doing here? Like, why does this even matter?" He said, "I really just didn't understand what she was doing until she explained it to me." He said, "But her whole theory and philosophy, and I assume she got that from her mother or some other people in the church, was she wanted to teach you about choice from a very young age. She wanted to give you the experience of learning how to choose." You know, and it was a no-lose scenario. Whether you chose the odd socks or the red sweater or whatever really didn't make a whole lot of difference. There were very limited consequences to that, those decisions. It was a safe decision time for you to make. But she taught you from a young age to make those sort of decisions. And it went all the way through. I remember when I was about 16, and a friend of mine, an older friend of mine, had just gotten himself a car. In Ireland, you generally speaking don't get cars when you're 16. It's just not as available as it is here. So he was probably about 18, and he just got himself a first car and kind of done it all up and got it running nice and whatever else. And so he invited me on Saturday nights, we'd go just driving around. And we lived in Dublin City, but it didn't take long to get out of Dublin and into the countryside. And we'd go flying around the countryside, you know, off the back roads, having all sorts of fun. We weren't doing anything that we weren't supposed to be doing. But oftentimes it entailed us being out till like 1 or 2 in the morning. Which to some degree my parents were like, "Hey, you're 16, it's not that big of a deal." The problem became on Sunday morning when I couldn't keep my eyes open during church. Church had always been something that was important to my family. And I couldn't keep my eyes open. I did this for weeks and weeks and weeks. And it was pretty much most weeks that me and my buddy Nigel would get in the car and just go off and just goof around in the countryside, just, you know, knocking on people's doors and running away, that sort of silly stuff, you know, just guys being guys, okay? I'm pretty sure it was my mother. I don't know this for sure, but I'm pretty sure my mother instigated this. But there was one afternoon, my parents called for me, and I came into the kitchen. They sat me down and closed the door behind me, and I'm like, "Oh." They're like, "We wanted to talk to you about this driving around with your friend Nigel thing." And I'm sitting there thinking, "We're not doing anything." I started defending myself. They're like, no, "You're okay. We trust you, but we have some concerns." And so I'm waiting for them. When they told me what it was about, I'm waiting for them to bring the hammer down. I'm waiting, here it comes, they're going to tell me I can't do that anymore, I have to be awake in church, that's not happening, that's a done deal, it's over. But they floored me, completely took me by surprise, because they told me all the reasons that they didn't like it. They told me things that my mother was fearful about us having a crash or something like that. She told me the biggest issue was being at church and not being awake to focus on worshiping God. She says, "You know, that's something that's been really important to us." I say, "I'm waiting for the hammer to come down." And they're like, "So, That's it. You're 16 now. It's your choice. And I was like, what? Cool. All right, well, thanks for this talk. This was great. Called up my buddy Nigel, and we promptly went out for the evening and came back at like 2 in the morning or something crazy like that. I think I may have done it for about 2 weeks after that. But while I was doing it, I'm thinking, she's right. Church is important to me too. My faith is important to me, and I'm sleeping through it. I don't want to do that. And so I stopped. I think my mom knew intuitively that church was important to me. She knew she'd raised me right. You know, the Bible says, train a child in the way that he should go and he won't depart from it. She trusted that and left the decision up to me. Great wisdom there. And it was something I didn't do for much more after that. I stopped it and changed it and started focusing on church being a more important part of my life. And not just being awake during it, but actually paying attention and focusing and getting the most out of it that I could. As Delia would say, it's just creepy. Mothers just seem to have a knack of knowing you, knowing what's going on. Elisa's the same way with our kids. I remember when my kids were younger, she was intent on putting them down for what she called unstructured playtime, alone time. You know, a lot of people kind of, it's very easy to kind of overstructure your kids. And she's like, I just want to put them down in the room. We'll close the door and they can spend an hour in there just gurgling or reading or whatever it is that they're going to do. But they need to learn to be alone. They're going to be alone a lot in their life. And it's good for them to learn how to be quiet with their own thoughts rattling around their head and not to just drive them crazy. I just thought it was great because I got to sit on the couch and watch TV in peace. But apparently there was a lot more going on. And even to this day now, we give our kids a quiet time on Sunday afternoons. They used to go do their Awana stuff, or they read their Wednesday night material for youth group. Or they just read, listen to some music, but they go be by themselves and just kind of give Elisa and I a bit of a break as well and preserve some of our sanity. But also, it's just a great thing for them to learn how to do. Say, I would never have thought of that myself. But mothers tend to just kind of seem to think of these things. They think more long-term, I think, oftentimes than us guys do. Proverbs 1, verse 7 says, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. It goes on to give exhortations to embrace wisdom. It says, listen, my son, to your father's instruction, and do not forsake your mother's teaching. Solomon here links the fear of the Lord with the beginning of wisdom with a mother's teaching of her children. No pressure, ladies. Probably the fifth reason that men are not mothers is transmission or communication. You know, guys, we love being under the hood, working with the transmission, but when it comes to actually transmitting good, solid information to our kids, sometimes we fall short. I think often, you know, we've obviously got a role in this, and God honors what we do, but women, mothers, tend to have the bulk of this load. John Piper described motherhood as the transmission of a God-centered, Christ-treasuring vision of life to your children. Within the student ministry, a lot of times I teach, but every so often or quite often we try to do things where it's more discussion-oriented and discussion-based, interactive. So it's not just me imparting information, it's getting a conversation going. Because the more you know about where they're at and what they're thinking spiritually, it's much easier to teach them from that and kind of move them to the next phase or the next step. If we don't know where they're at, sometimes you're just shooting over their heads or else you're shooting under their feet. But when you've got that conversation, that interaction going, it's easier to kind of hit the mark of where they are. In many ways, conversation is the key to learning. A lot of the best ministry moments that I have happen after youth group, or before youth group, or at a time where youth group is not happening at all. It's just the relationships that have been built up with the students. They come and contact me about something that they're dealing with and going through, and I'm able to speak truth into their life right where they are at. Oftentimes, I think the lessons and stuff that I teach or whatever the youth, I may scratch 3 or 4 kids where they're itching right now, but a lot of kids are just not there yet, or they're not experiencing that right now. They're still learning, but it's not as impactful as when it's like right where they are. When I hit my teenage years, I did what probably most teenagers do. And I kind of started to block my parents out a little bit. I don't think it was intentional. Some of it is I was kind of trapped in my own thoughts a lot of times. But I would get home from school and I'd pull up the garage door, walk through into the kitchen. And as soon as I was into the house, my mom learned real quick, once I was in the house, forget trying to have a conversation. She would ask me questions, you know, how was your day? She'd get a grunt. Well, that's okay. You know, how'd that test go? And she'd get like nothing from me. I say, I wasn't doing it intentionally. It was just kind of how I was kind of wired at the time. I would think about stuff all the way home, but once I hit the doors, once I got into the house, it was like I just crashed. And she couldn't get a thing out of me. It drove her nuts. She's like, I got to figure out a way to unlock this kid. I want to know what's going on in his life. Well, I think she stumbled across it by accident one day, but she was out in the garage getting something out of the freezer when I happened to come home. And so I pulled up the garage door, and there she was, leaning into the freezer, pulling something out. And so she just casually turned around and said, how was your day? And I talked her ear off. We walked into the house, and I'm still going. And she's like, oh my goodness, all this stuff's been going on every day, and I never knew. She's like, why today would he just unload all this stuff as opposed to every other day for the last however many years, and I couldn't get a thing out of him? Somewhere along the way, she figured out that once I hit the house, I'm done. And she would position herself. She'd time it. She knew roughly when I got home, and she'd hear that garage door fly up, and she'd position herself at the kitchen door. And oftentimes, and I didn't realize this till after she told me this, but I can remember times where the garage door would come up, I'd walk in, I'd kind of dump my bike, I'd head for the kitchen door, and the kitchen door would swing open. And there's my mom. Hey, how was your day? And blah, off I'd go. And she'd get all the latest updates on what I was thinking, everything. I'm sure I bored her to death with half of the details that I shared. But as a mom, she's patient and she wanted to hear all of that. She wanted to know what I was doing. And at the same time, as not just listening to me, as I'm sharing what I'm dealing with and what I'm struggling with and what I'm going through and my highs and my lows and all this stuff, she's able to impart godly wisdom right where I was at. Effectively and impactfully. And I still remember those calls. Like even today, if I call home and my dad answers the phone, there's like a 3-minute awkward conversation where my dad's trying to probe me for stuff and I'm trying to talk with him sort of thing. And then, and usually either I'll ask for my mom or he'll realize this isn't going anywhere. Hey, let me get your mom. And he gets the scoop from her later on and then I'll chat with my mom for an hour. Even to this day, that's kind of how things operate. When Elisa and I were first married, it was interesting because mealtimes in her home were very purposeful events for her parents. They talked a lot. They would talk about politics, spiritual things, their lives, high lows. That was the mealtime was the time where they conversed as a family. And the parents imparted just knowledge and wisdom and challenging things for them to kids to think about, that sort of thing. In my home, and there was just the two of them, there was Elisa and her brother. In my home, there was three boys and a girl, and we were just all over the place. As we got into our teenage years, dinner times for us ceased to be at the table and became in front of the TV. So when we first got married, I used to drive her crazy, and she would drive me crazy. Because mealtimes went a little bit like this. We'd sit down to this wonderful meal that she'd cooked. And she can cook really well. And I eat really well, so it's a great combination. And I'd grab a fork full of food, shove it in my mouth, and off I go. We're there to eat, right? She'd start asking questions. And she managed to time her questions perfectly till just after I got a fork full of food. So I had a mouthful of food, and she'd ask me something, and I'd be And I'd give her about the shortest answer I could get out and grab another fork full of food. Then she'd ask me another question. And I was driving her nuts because I wouldn't talk. And she was driving me nuts because she's interrupting my eating. I'm like, come on, food here. Don't interrupt. This is sacred. Let's wait till we're done. We finally figured out what was going on and discussed it. And she told me that in her family, mealtimes were a really important time for her to converse with her family and connect with her parents and talk about just the stuff of life, spiritual things very often. And she says, as we're going to have kids, I want mealtimes to be a time where we do that. She says, you're going to have to slow down and not be just so completely focused on the eating that you actually take time to have a conversation. I had to train myself. I still don't do great at it now. Food is just so, such a draw there for me. But our mealtimes right now with our kids, we sit at the table most every night, unless there's like a really important game on TV or something like that. But for the most part, it still drives me nuts at Thanksgiving because the Cowboys are playing at Thanksgiving and my mother-in-law manages to time dinner to come out right as the Cowboys are about to start. And in her house, the TV goes off when the meal's on the table. And I'm like, okay, I'll just sit and get the updates on my phone. Yes, great meal here. But it's amazing some of the things I find that we talk about at the meal table. Kids talk about their day. We just talk about people in our lives and what God's doing. We talk about spiritual things. We talk about politics. We talk about just soccer, a lot of soccer. I'm pretty obsessed about soccer. But God has used so many of those conversations in the shaping and molding of our kids. And one of my favorite things to watch Elisa do is when she's in the kitchen cooking. And oftentimes it's Sophia, but sometimes it's the other two as well. Sophia will just perch herself on a stool by the counter and just chat. And Elisa's just talking with her, building that relationship and imparting truth and knowledge into her life. And it's in those, in many ways, they're divine moments, but it's in the mundane of life where mothers especially have such an incredible opportunity to impart truth and wisdom into our kids' lives. 2 Timothy 1 says, I am reminded of your sincere faith. This is Paul writing to Timothy. Which first lived in your grandmother Lois, and then in your mother Eunice, and now I'm persuaded lives in you also. It's a brilliant verse about how Timothy was raised. Timothy's father was a Greek, a non-believer. But his grandmother Lois had been a believer, and his mother Eunice was a believer. And Paul basically traces the lineage back. He says, look, your grandmother Lois followed Christ and passed that on to her daughter Eunice. And her daughter Eunice is now has passed it on to you, Timothy. 2 Timothy 3, he said, but as for you, continue in what you have learned and become convinced of, because you know those from whom you have learned it, and how from infancy you have known the Holy Scriptures, which are able to make you wise for salvation through faith in Jesus Christ. That's a role that just cannot be understated or underestimated, and it's such an incredible privilege that you ladies have to impart Scripture and truth and wisdom into your kids' lives, and such a joy, I know, for us men to watch you do that and to be a part of some of that. But you guys get the main bulk of that, of that opportunity. One of my dad's favorite verses, and he used to quote it to us often, was Psalm 127. He said, like arrows in the hands of a warrior are children born in one's youth. Blessed is the man whose quiver is full of them. The quiver is the bit where you keep all the arrows and you've got the bow. The thing it doesn't talk about in that verse is who's holding the bow. When you shoot the arrow, that bow is being aimed. And I think, obviously, both parents are shooting their fair share of arrows in the direction that the Lord is calling them to. But I think mothers have the bulk of that job description, get the bulk of the opportunity of guiding their children to the glory of God. I want to end by showing you guys a short video. Some of you guys may have seen this. It's been out recently. It's out by the Skit Guys. It's out by the Skit Guys. Some of you guys have probably seen it running around on Facebook, but it's just an incredible... It fits perfectly with the sermon because it shows why men should never be mothers. But it's just... it's a great just way of hopefully honoring and valuing everything you do, and we can't begin to put a value on it. So I just want to say thank you to all you ladies who are mothers. If my mom's listening to this, I want to thank you especially, and thank my wife as well for what she's doing, investing in our own kids. But I'll leave you with this.